Good morning and welcome to the June 26, 2023 meeting of the Chelan Public Utilities Commission. Today we have three commissioners present, the other two excused, one that we're all anxious to hear feedback from Northwest Public Power Boot Camp. Commissioner Kelly Allen is attending that this weekend, or this week. Our regular staff are in the room, Eric Walquist, the district attorney, Rebecca Newman, the clerk of the board, and Kirk Hudson, our general manager. We would ask that you check your electronic devices to make sure that they're placed in the silent mode, which I haven't done yet, so I will, to assist in not disrupting our today's meeting. We do value the public input at our meetings, and we'll be providing an opportunity for public to have input at the end of our morning session, at the end of the afternoon session. And if you wish to speak, we ask that you provide your name and address for the record, as our meetings are recorded and we wish to have an accurate record of your input. Additionally, we ask that you limit your comments to 3 minutes. And on top of that, I see a number of guests in the room today, and I believe they probably desire to speak to a specific agenda item, and we'll provide that opportunity for anybody to speak to agenda items as we go. Our flag salute and our safety minute will be brought to us today by Mitchell Clark. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good morning, commissioners. So I'm Mitch Clark. I'm a senior project manager with the Rocky Reach Lake Chelan EPM team, and I have the HPI minute for today. All right, so I wanted to talk about hazard identification as it relates to the 4th of July holiday coming up next week. So as next week is the 4th of July, many of us are going to be celebrating with numerous activities, and I just wanted to take some time to go through what are some of the potential hazards associated with each of these activities and some of the potential mitigations that could be in place to reduce the likelihood or severity of any of these hazards. So the first one we had was just with grilling and cooking. Obviously, burns is a hazard associated with that. So following the manufacturer's recommended lighting instructions, keeping children and pets at least 3 feet away from the grill area. Uncontrolled fire. Sorry, I'm ahead of you.
Thank you.
I'm on third slide. Yeah. Now. Sorry. Should I be controlling this? Sorry. uncontrolled fire. So ensuring your grill is cleaned regularly, prevent buildup of flammable greases. Ensuring your grill is at least 2 feet away from any adjacent flammable structures. Foodborne illness. A lot of us will be having outdoor picnics and stuff like that over the next week. So keeping cold foods cold, less than 40 degrees Fahrenheit, and hot foods hot over 140 prevents the growth of foodborne bacteria. And if it's not going to be either heated or cooled, once served, food should not sit out for more than 2 hours or 1 hour if the temperature is over 90 degrees Fahrenheit. Fireworks. So starting a fire is a hazard associated with that. And then also burns and personal injuries are another hazard associated with that. So as of this year, personal fireworks are banned throughout Chelan and Douglas counties, including East Wenatchee. So consider watching the community fireworks show at Walla Walla Park. All right. Water activities. So the main hazard associated with water activities is obviously drowning. So while boating, ensuring life jackets are available for each person, and then children under 12 must wear a properly fitted life jacket while on a moving boat. Rivers and streams are inherently dangerous places to recreate. So wear a personal flotation device and watch children closely when on or near moving water. And then you can, you know, reduce that risk by choosing a safer swimming option such as a lake or a pool. And then lastly, limiting alcohol use while on the water. Alcohol use has been shown to increase risk factors quite a bit associated with drowning. Other outdoor activities. It is supposed to be hot next week, so heat exhaustion, heat stroke are always a concern. So to mitigate that, get plenty to drink, limiting both caffeine and alcohol. Choose lightweight and loose-fitting clothing. Try to schedule your outdoor activities during cooler parts of the day and rest often during peak temperature times. Sunburns can affect your body's ability to cool down, so protect yourself with sun-blocking clothing and sunscreen with an SPF 15 or higher. And lastly, bug bites. You can avoid ticks by walking in the center of trails and staying out of wooded and bushy areas with high grass and leaf litter. And you can avoid mosquitoes with long sleeve shirts and long pants. And utilize EPA registered insect repellents. So I just wanted to go over those just as kind of a brief example of things you could look out for. So I just ask everyone, as you're planning an activity or starting a new activity, just take a minute to consider what are the possible hazards associated with that. Obviously, that applies to both in work and outside of work activities, you know, pretty much everything that we do. And we should take a minute to think about what are the hazards associated with it, and then taking the proactive steps to ensure that any mitigations that are come up with are put in place before that activity starts. And obviously, we do that to protect ourselves, protect our loved ones, and protect our property, our assets here at the district. Any questions?
No, good coverage. It just brings back the adage when I was raised, don't eat the potato salad after it's been out in the sun for an hour.
Good advice. Good advice. Thank you, everybody.
You bet. Thank you.
Thanks, Mitch.
Commissioners, we have a proposed agenda before us. In addition, management has suggested that it would be appropriate to move resolution number 12 to the consent agenda with, if there's no objection. So if I hear no objection, we will approve the agenda with the revision of moving resolution number 12 to the consent agenda. All right. CPO winner recognition.
Okay. I'd like to invite Chase Fitzpatrick up. Chase was actually one of our May award winners. You'll see the other May award winner at the next board meeting. Chase works in our meter shop, and Chase was nominated for the work that he did for, in particular, one large irrigation customer. And what had to happen in this particular case was that the 2G wireless network that was used for the meters for this customer was being phased out. The 2G network was being phased out. And Chase was assigned the duty of replacing these meters for this large customer, and he had a short window to do it. And something like this, of course, you want to do it outside the normal irrigation season. And so Chase did all the research associated with it, actually purchased a meter to test, make sure it would work, and then installed several meters all in the short window that he had for the irrigation customer. And they actually got the work done before the irrigation season. So it was a great example of being nominated for this cycle of personal ownership, and the ownership that he exhibited was taking this from start to finish, doing all the research, the homework, the testing, troubleshooting, and everything along the way to make sure the customer had an operation that was working when the irrigation started. So congratulations, Chase. Just appreciate all the work. Chase is also heavily involved in the AMI meter deployment as we speak. Very knowledgeable on that new system, and just glad to have him here. So congratulations, Chase.
Thank you.
Comments. You have the floor, Chase.
The new meters that we put there for LCRD were kind of a special contract that we have agreements with LCRD and BPA to wheel power for them, and so they're not really a revenue meter for us. They are required to be up and running during pump season, and it was perfect storm of LCRD was changing all of their switch gear out and all their stuff, so they had new equipment, and then right at the same time, Verizon had said that they are no longer going to support 2G or 3G cellular networks, so I had to find a different meter along with the new stuff that they had going in. And right at that time, we actually had AMI was going to be implemented, but we didn't know if it was going to be available at that time. So it was kind of a bunch of stuff all at once. And a lot of those stations don't have revenue-style metering sockets, so manufacturers having an issue trying to get their stuff to match up with ours. And it was what can go wrong will go wrong. And so it was a lot of making sure everything was done right. So I appreciate the award.
LCRD.
Lake Chelan Reclamation District.
Yep. They've got at least seven to eight stations up there that they all kind of intertie with the whole system they have for the farmers and all the water in that area.
And thousands of acres of orchard relying on that system.
Yeah, I was going to say, all of a sudden, that recognition of that acronym just realized what you were. Yeah.
It just hit me, too.
What you were dealing with.
And I've actually been up there when one of those pump stations has gone down, and it is everyone's just running and scrambling, and farmers are calling, and it can be a bad thing if they're not set up right. But everyone worked with me on this, and it was actually great to have all the other electricians and Lake Chelan District, their guys there, and the engineers and everything was on board, and everyone was on the same page, which actually worked out very well.
That's great.
Oh, no, I see Lake Chelan. I should have read that. So anyway, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Great job, Chase. Before you leave, I just want to say this is another example of staff going above and beyond to make sure that the systems work. The implications of this, if it didn't work, were huge. The exposure to the district would have been huge if we were caused all these trees to die. So it was just a job well done. And thank you for dogging that down and just staying with it. It sounds extremely complex.
A little testy.
Thank you. Well, good job.
Thanks, Chase. Yeah. And now, correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't the Reclamation District get a lot of their pump power from Bonneville?
Yep. Chase was describing that pretty well. Yeah.
So it's, I mean, they're sort of a customer.
Yeah. Bureau of Reclamation. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Next is a review of a proposed term sheet of property for sale to the YMCA.
So with us is Justin Erickson and David Lodge, and this is a proposed terms, if you will. So no decisions are required today. In essence, this will be the basis of an agreement that would come back to the board for approval, but this is the opportunity for the board to hear those terms and provide feedback or input whether or not you'd like something changed. And there will be public comment as part of this as well.
So. Great. Thank you. Good morning, commissioners. David and I are pleased to be here with you and provide this update. What we're planning on covering today is just a general update on where we are overall with the redevelopment project. We will also review specific provisions of the term sheet with the YMCA. And as Kirk noted, got a number of individuals here that may want to provide a comment, so we'll provide a space for that, both from the YMCA as well as general public comment. And then we'll close out with speaking very directly about our staff recommendation and next steps.
So first I want to go back just for a minute and talk about how we got to where we are now. So in 2022, in coordination with community partners, we did a request for proposals for redevelopment consistent with the community vision plan that we had adopted in 2020. And through that process, it was determined the proposals didn't meet our redevelopment goals for the district. And so in November, the board directed staff to prepare several options for redevelopment. And we presented those in February, five different options, and received direction from the board at that time to initiate discussions with the YMCA and Music Theater of Wenatchee and continue to evaluate options for the remainder of the site. So since February, we've met with the YMCA on a biweekly basis to develop and negotiate a term sheet, which we'll be presenting today. And through that, we developed a plan to transfer the building demolition and site preparation to the YMCA as part of the purchase, recognized as a credit to the price. And then we've developed a draft terms that benefit both PUD and the YMCA. Concurrent with that, we've met with Music Theater of Wenatchee. We met in April to discuss the minimum area needed. They do have parking needs, but we said, what do you need for the majority of your operations, not for the largest show? And so we've been able to identify those needs. We met in May to negotiate a price and other terms, and we're working towards those conversations are progressing in a positive way. So YMCA term sheet. This is a non-binding document that lays out the key terms that would be included in a purchase and sale agreement. So in summary, YMCA purchased approximately 85,000 square feet, which would be in the middle of the eastern portion of the campus, currently the tech shop and the service building, for the construction of a new YMCA facility. The YMCA would assume the cost for demolition and site preparation. So for consideration, the appraised value of those parcels, if vacant, so if there was nothing on it, would be $1.49 million. And we've estimated a credit for the cost of demolition, disposal, and site prep at $1.09 million. So the resulting price that the YMCA would pay to the district is $400,000. Other terms would be PUD responsibilities and YMCA responsibilities. So the PUD will construct, directly or indirectly, but will take responsibility for constructing a roadway and sidewalk, provide circulation for the entire campus redevelopment, connecting Fifth Street and Wenatchee Avenue through the interior of the site, because these two parcels are interior to the site and need access. We'll also relocate utility infrastructure that's currently located on the parcels and provide access to utilities. The YMCA will take on the demolition of the tech shop and utility services building for their needs up to the existing exterior wall of the warehouse. The PUD would take demo beyond that point. And then the YMCA will assume the disposal and site preparation of the parcels. So other items that are included in the term sheet are we will create a commercial owners association for the maintenance of the common areas for the site circulation, and also we're contemplating some shared parking. And the PUD retains responsibility for any environmental contamination issue, none known on these parcels, but if they're encountered during the course of demolition and site prep. So looking at a site map, the parcels we're referring to are parcels 6 and 7. So those would be the parcels that the YMCA would purchase through our purchase and sale agreement, which they were just presenting the term sheet. And then other updates on this. So parcel 5 is what the music theater would require for minimum parking needs, and it leaves a space in between that could be a shared parking that we're contemplating at this time. So 4 and 5 is what we're working on with music theater.
Okay. Mr. President, this is the time we have reserved in the presentation for comments from the YMCA. I believe Dory Foster, CEO of the YMCA, would like to speak.
Good morning. Thanks for having me here, and thanks for allowing us to work with David and Dan. It is wonderful to work with them. Their enthusiasm matches ours for us being here, so thank you for that. The opportunity to be a trusted anchor business is not taken lightly, and we've taken this very seriously moving forward from February on. Our goal is to present and create a vibrant community hub, basically, that respects our collective legacies for the next 100 years. So thank you. We are now, with the term agreement presented, we have been able to work with our team of Absher and ALSC to design schematic designs for the site, now that the site is somewhat determined on where it may be. We have design principles that respect flexibility, adaptability, and maybe perhaps something uniquely Wenatchee, that along with 15 other things that are on the list. We anticipate bringing these schematic designs to our donors, our friends, and YMCA members in July and early August, and also anticipate being able to go public, more public, with all of that in late August, early September. We have just received a gift notice, over $900,000 last week, of a private gift. So we are now at $10 million raised to date, and that includes state funding for the recent change in our plans, which is site acquisition and site preparation for this site. So thank you to the state representatives for that. With the purchase and sale agreement and hopefully the subsequent property transfer, you can see on the timeline, we are looking for demolition at the end of first quarter 2024. And although the contractors say August 2025, we know how that works. So I'll give them to the end of August, end of 2025 and hopefully be in our new YMCA facility. So thank you for the opportunity. Any questions?
That's great.
Yeah. Good progress.
You're justifiably excited.
Good. Yes, for sure.
I think we all are excited to see the progress that's been made, and to know that the YMCA will be finding a new home here on our campus.
Yeah,
the great use of the land that that exists here, and I think it's a good use of the YMCA's resources to move. It's a beautiful building, and I spent time on the board at the Y many years ago, but I'm very familiar with how old it is. Mm-hmm. It has more than outlived its useful purpose.
As a YMCA.
As the old YMCA, yes. It'll find a new owner at some point, but absolutely. You. So we're very happy.
Great.
Well, it's also really, I mean, as we get closer to the date that the utility moves from this facility, the fact that we have a commitment that we made to the downtown business community to make something really positive happen here, you know, as time gets shorter, it gets more real.
Yeah.
And we're looking forward to the next steps.
Us too.
Yeah, I was going to note, that, and I think you were hinting at that, it's her timeline that she laid out there is not long after the last department's moved out of this facility. So in short order, they're interested in starting work, which is exciting.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you. Thank you for allowing us to be that trusted anchor.
So. You bet. I see a number of people in the audience that may wish to make additional comments. Are there any additional comments? Well, I'll let you close it out.
Okay, I'll close it out then, sir. Thank you. So in conclusion, it is the staff recommendation with the board's concurrence, that we develop a purchase and sales agreement with the Wenatchee Valley YMCA in terms substantially similar to those included in the negotiated term sheet. And we anticipate presenting that to you for approval. We're going to do it as soon as possible. I know that's the intent of both parties. We do think that's probably sometime late this summer, hopefully. We're targeting September. Be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Commissioners, any questions? Sort of looking for a nod of the head to move forward then?
Yes, sir.
You bet.
Yeah. Yes. All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank
you. Yes. When...
Either seat works. I'm Bart Clannon, live at 29 Dana Street. And first, I just want to thank all of you for what you're accomplishing. It's amazing. It's just our whole community, where we are and the things that are taking place. And I guess the only comment I want to add, and it's maybe too early, but make sure you coordinate with the Reimagine downtown work that's taking place, you know, streets, sidewalks, all that. It's really important that we get together as a group and make everything fit. So I just want to encourage you to make sure that takes place along the way.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bart.
Thank you, Bart.
All right. Any other public comment? Well, thank you again. All right. We'll move on to our quarterly electrical load growth.
Yeah, with us is Andy Wendell. Andy is going to provide the latest. Oh, and Chad Rissman is with us as well. Latest activity that's happening in the county regarding electrical load growth. He's going to talk a little bit about water and wastewater as well. Good morning.
Thank you. Morning, Commissioners. Morning, Commissioners. It's hard to believe we're already into June of the year. It's flying by. We're here today to talk about our quarterly load update on the electric system. We'll look at how many electric meters we've installed to date. We'll talk a little bit about some of the applications and inquiries for new services that we're receiving since the last quarter. In particular, a little focus on the electrical vehicle charging stations. In response to a question of the last quarterly update regarding water and wastewater planning methodologies, we took an opportunity to respond to those questions in this quarterly update. Our colleague Ron Slabaugh, who's really the chief planner of our water and wastewater systems, wasn't able to join us today, but I'll Chad and I will do our best to try to cover those bases. We've got a very aggressive substation build plan, so we'll bring you some updates on that. Just as a reminder, there's no action requested today from the board. So here's a snapshot of kind of our five-year look back on new electric meters. You can see over there on the right-hand side, we're at about 153 new meters for residential and about 35 new commercial meters year-to-date with no industrial meters. Here in the next few weeks and maybe over a month, we anticipate that number to bump up significantly as some of the new multifamily housing developments receive their new meters, hopefully advanced meters as we put those in. And just as a reminder, we tend to get about 60% of our total annual meters in that last quarter of the year. So we're well on the projection to having another close to 800 to 1,000 meters again in 2023. Some of the notable applications and inquiries coming through our application process. Over the last year, so we've had an increase in interest in installing new level 3 fast chargers throughout our territory, and we'll talk a little bit more about those in just a moment. In addition, we see an increase in homeowners and businesses inquiring about the level 1 and level 2 electrical vehicle charging stations. From a development standpoint, there's been a renewed interest in the Chelan Butte vicinity for new development. I think the last time this popped up was around 2017, 2018. There is a proposal for around 200 single lot development down in that Chelan Butte area. We don't know all the details on that at this point in time, but we're working with a developer and looking at that closely. Link Transit is looking at a feasibility to install a new charging station, a battery storage system that would be able to charge their buses during off-peak, charging a battery on off-peak time and then charging during the day. They don't have the exact size nailed down yet, but it's somewhere between a 3 and a 9 megawatt hour charging infrastructure. That's pretty significant, and the PUD is working closely with Link to understand both the impacts from an electric system standpoint and its operating parameters. So more to come on that.
So Andy, if I might interject on that, when we were last week over at American Public Power Association meeting, happened to have lunch with a couple of ladies, one from King County Metro, who is in charge of electrifying their fleet. And she is referring to what Richard DeRock is doing here is significant. And they're paying attention to Link at King County Metro, just to give you sort of a flavor of Richard's respected. So
that's great.
Yeah.
Well, certainly Link's adventures into full electric buses. Yes. Kind of paved the way for that. So
it's caught the eye of people in the Northwest.
Right. So we believe this battery storage systems is kind of that next evolution in transportation and charging. So we're keeping a close eye on that for sure. In addition, we've had a few residential developments that have signaled to us that they're either pausing or decreasing both the scope and the schedule of some of their build-outs. I think it's fair to say that the housing markets in terms of single family homes have slowed down a little bit. But what's interesting is we still see a big push for multifamily housing, new development in the county too. So we are continuing to watch that, and we are receiving inquiries and applications for some smaller developments in 2023 as well. So we wanted to shift and talk a little bit more about electrical demand of the EV charging stations. And I think Chad plans to weigh in a little bit here too, but I think most of us are familiar with, there's really kind of three categories for charging stations, level 1, 2, and 3, where 1 is essentially just a plug-in, a standard extension cord in a home, something that's going to slow charge a battery and take many hours to do that. Of course, those are behind the meter.
are low profile and they're generally low impact on consumers electric. The level two, little different story. These are generally, they are single phase, but they're larger in amperage. You can see they vary based on 12 to 80 amps. Just to put that in perspective, an 80 amp service would be equivalent to say a furnace in a home, a heating furnace, something of that nature, or a dryer, a large, dryer operating. So they can be significant in terms of energy consumption. What's interesting that we find is most level two charging stations are behind the meter, meaning they're past our point of delivery. So we don't have a real good handle on how many are out there, but they are very affordable and they're very popular among the EV charging stations. Where that will come into play for us is just understanding the impacts of the level two chargers on distribution transformers that were designed for homes that, maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago that didn't have EV cars as an appliance. So we're watching that very closely. The ones that are of most interest to the utility from a planning standpoint and an energy standpoint are the DC fast chargers. You can see that they're generally exceeding 100 amps. They're three phase. A lot of times they're 480 volt three phase. They can be anywhere between 50 and 350 kW. So a small grocery store may operate on 350 kW as a peak, to put that in perspective. It's that instantaneous peak demand and having multiple level three charging stations centralized in one location that give us the greatest concern.
So quick question on that chart, looking at the level three charger and the charging time, it says 60 to 80 miles in 20 minutes. What does that exactly mean?
Well, that's generally how fast Chad drives.
That's not fast enough.
What that is stating is that if you plug into that DC charger, that fast charger, and you charge for a 20-minute period, you'll increase your range by about 60 to 80 miles.
Okay, so for a full charge of 400 miles, it's still going to take a couple of 3 hours maybe.
Right.
Okay. On a level three.
That's right.
Okay. I thought that was the case, but I wasn't sure. So.
Yeah. They're designed to primarily give you just that added lift to get that distance in a short period of time. This next slide shows just the graphical view of where we know there's level three charging stations across the county in red there. Leavenworth as a destination area is pretty popular. And as well as Wenatchee, there's a few in Wenatchee, and there's a Tesla DC fast charger in the Inia area as well. But you can see there's interest in additional charging stations, both in Manson, Chelan, and Wenatchee. So we're looking at those very closely. Some of them are just conversations. Some of them are embedded in applications. But there's definitely growth in that particular area, and I think we can anticipate more growth as we move forward. Back to that slide, I just wanted to let you know where we are at. With the level ones, of course, there's an unknown quantity, right? But we know there's a lot of residential there's a lot of people in this county that live here that are driving EVs today, and that number is increasing. So it's fair to say that there's quite a number of level ones. Level twos, in terms of public accessible level twos, these are ones where you can pull into public space and charge your car. We believe there's somewhere in the area of two dozen across the county. Many, many more. For instance, a new hotel or a new school or a new large facility office buildings, generally speaking, they're incorporating some level of level two charging stations within their parking space. So it's fair to say there's a lot of that out there. Again, those are behind the meter, so we really don't know the exact quantity. We're estimating somewhere between 0.25 and 0.5 megawatts is a total demand for level two charging stations. And again, in the DC fast chargers for public accessible, there's approximately six stations countywide with a demand of between 1 and 2 megawatts. That potential increase with applications that we see today and growth both in level two and level threes, we think there's an additional 1 to 2 megawatts on the horizon over the next, you know, 2 to 3 years. So,
question: do you see a future where DC fast chargers might be integrated into a residential application?
Boy, I certainly don't. I mean, the fact that they're three-phase power, most residential communities are designed for single-phase power. I do believe that we'll probably see more distributed level three chargers in kind of communities, right? But to be in the neighborhoods themselves, likely not. But I don't know, Chad, you've been studying this a little bit. Do you have some thoughts around
that? I would agree with that. The utility infrastructure can be there, but to utilize the existing infrastructure that's there, it's just not going to be very conducive in most applications. There's obviously going to be exceptions to that, but and it could be planned too. I mean, if it was a new development, that could be part of the plan potentially. That is a fairly large development. Maybe there's a community charging station, and the utility infrastructure would be planned according to what was planned for inside there. So, might have your community pool and your community center for that development, and maybe a community charging center, which could be a level three something. That seems to make a little bit more sense to me, rather than the individual homes, as Andy said.
So. Yeah. So the keeping our eye on the ball really would be for level two.
For residents.
I'm just guessing. You know, this is pure guess. Maybe you can help bring some clarity to it. But level one takes so long to charge. Maybe I'm just an impatient guy, but if I had a full EV, plugging it into a 110 outlet, it would take too long for my purpose of coming and going when I wished to come and go. And I would think that most people that would have a full EV might prefer the fastest charge possible, which is where I was asking about level three, is, you know, could it ever morph to that? But I think level two is more likely.
You'll probably get some folks that are very much interested in that, but it seems like the level one and level two, from most of the conversation, and we're not experts in this subject, just trying to understand how that translates
right
to utility infrastructure and planning and ensuring that we have the capacity available for our customers, however they want to be able to use that. But it seems like most folks, if they're going the route of the EVs, are able to get charging through the night, and that gives them enough miles to be able to do their local commutes and things. And if they're planning on doing longer trips, spend a little bit more time figuring out how they would make that work. But I know quite a few people that are making it work with the lower level charges and are very satisfied with that too. So I think it all depends on kind of, you know, where your bottom line is. Or
do you see the growth of EVs really being a factor in demand throughout the county as these become more popular?
So Jim White and Daniel Scott, engineering and our conservation group, are spending a lot of time looking at that and trying to understand that. There's some databases that are being developed based on usage that we're gaining some information from. And I think what would work in our favor, and somewhat, was that if charging occurred opposite of when our peaks occurred, and it looks like there might be at least some overlap of that. So there's potentially some opportunity. So we're trying to understand that. And the DC fast chargers, or these larger chargers, in some senses might be easier to manage, because they'll be tied to an application, they'll be planning and things that are associated with those, where the level ones, if there was quite a bit of penetration, there isn't necessarily an application tied to those. So those could be occurring organically and have a larger impact on our system that is unplanned, that we would be in a position to react to. So trying to pay attention to all of these things is going to be really important. Yeah.
As level two increases in homes, I'm taking for granted, but it's a question, they're going to have to get a building or an electrical permit to add that to their load. Do we get that information from LNI on those, or is that an LNI permit, or is that, it's behind the meter, so it's not a permit or application for us, is it?
Generally, it's just with LNI, unless it results in the customer having to increase the panel size.
Right.
If they have to go, say, from 100 amp to a 200 amp or a 200 to a 400 amp, then when we would be brought into that, we would know that. Just on that topic, I want to let you know that I was just visiting with our Itron meter manufacturer for advanced meters this week, and was looking at some technology that they're working on to be able to help identify EVs and EV charging beyond the meter. This will help utilities kind of segregate general energy consumption and that EV charging to understand time of use in that spectrum. And in some utilities, they're looking at that as a tool to partner with EV owners to, as Chad was saying, looking at the opportunities to charge off-peak and possibly have various rates that would incent off-peak charging. So the technology is advancing, and we want you to know that we're, as Chad mentioned, we are not experts on this, but we're watching it very closely, and we're learning a lot as we go, and we will bring forward suggestions and strategies as we know more.
So Andy, so, back to my question, does LNI give us that information of how many applications are being?
No.
Okay.
No. I mean, we have a view into electrical permits pulled by customers, and there's some information on there about, you know, what they may be doing, but generally speaking, it's not going to highlight, hey, this permit is pulled for an electrical vehicle charging station.
So that Itron meter that you mentioned, I'm assuming that would only be installed if a customer requested it to have a view beyond the meter, up by the meter, because there's a privacy.
Sure. Yeah, I understand. The meters that we have today are not looking at EV charging.
Right.
You could certainly presume, based on the load profile, that there's potential charging going on there. What Itron is doing is looking at what is referred to as sub-metering, right? It's been able to look at a load profile and segregate specific loads. So separate the EV charging state. Charging load from additional home load. And again, the value proposition there is to try to incent that energy consumption to be off-peak times, right? Yeah. So a customer could potentially subscribe to that service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to say something here that as we're talking about EVs, and of course that's going to be the largest consumption addition for most residences. I was reminded by a friend of mine who recently switched over from a gas lawnmower to an electric lawnmower, from a gas chainsaw to an electric chainsaw, and my wife just bought an electric blower, and I have an Echo gas one that now is going to get sold at a garage sale. So I think what we're seeing really is this additional electrification of many different type homeowner appliances as well as EVs that they may not take as much power as an EV, but collectively, if you spread them out throughout the county, they will have some kind of a footprint recognizable to increase consumption. So it's definitely taking hold.
I have a blower, chainsaw, and weed eater that all use the same battery. You know, yeah. So, I mean, yes, the change is occurring. It really is.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the beauty of them is the battery runs down before I do.
It makes you feel good, doesn't it? Okay, maybe we can move on to finish your questions there.
Yeah.
On EV, and we'll be bringing more back to you as we learn more about what's coming down the pipe. Shifting gears to water and wastewater capacity planning. So we evaluate flows, actual flows, on an ongoing basis, and we monitor those. We put them into monthly discharge reports, and we send them to the Department of Ecology. And what we're looking for there, what DOE is looking for there, is any time that our flows exceed 85% of the design criteria in a treatment plant. So we exceed 85% of that for three consecutive months or more. Then we're required to put together you know, a planning, what they call a planning maintenance adequate capacity plan, or doing a feasibility on expanding that capacity. And we've done that on all of our systems, and we continue to do that. I'll talk a little bit more about that. But one thing to note is down there on the bottom, we highlight that, you know, that plan maintenance adequacy and capacity plan, that's primarily designed for our what we refer to as organic growth. In our systems, that's like 1 to 4 new wastewater connections a year. It doesn't seem like a lot, but we don't have large systems. Anything beyond that, particularly in one application, is generally not considered as organic growth. So some examples of that have come into our spectrum over the last couple of years is the Mission Ridge expansion area, right? Kaler Glen has applied to connect to the Lake Wenatchee wastewater system and Peshastin. And so the way we're managing those today is those kind of trigger an independent study to evaluate kind of what would be needed to accommodate those areas within our systems. And they're generally big lifts. Okay.
So maybe this is not the right time or place, but you, Kaler Glen applying to be part of the Lake Wenatchee system, that's significant.
It's very significant.
And probably topic for another day, what's driving it? Are they having phosphorus issues with their drain field system and such?
Yeah, I don't know that answer. We can get that answer for you. I know that Ron Slabaugh is very familiar with that. But clearly, you know, in an area like that, being on a wastewater system where we're transporting that wastewater to a treatment plant, it has got to be a better system for them. But we can bring that information back. Continuing wastewater planning, our capacity, our forecasts look over a 20-year period. And again, that's looking at about a 1% growth, or somewhere between 1 and 4 connections per year. So it's taking that growth, that 1% over a 20-year period. Some of the applications that we've received are consuming what would be 20 years of growth in one application. Those are some of the challenges that we're dealing with. Capacity planning has been completed in all 3 systems, including Dryden, which was completed in 2020, and we're actually under construction on that system as we speak. Peshastin system was updated in 2015, and those improvements have been completed. And then Lake Wenatchee was updated in 2014, and those were also completed as well. So we're maintaining our requirements with DOE and watching those wastewater applications very, very closely. Shifting to the water capacity planning, we complete and revise a comprehensive water plan every 6 years. And those demand forecasts and capacity forecasts are compared to our systems and the infrastructure within those systems. Infrastructure could include, but not limited to, main water lines, water reservoirs, water pumping stations, those larger assets. When we do those comprehensive plans, we tend to identify those capital improvements or those projects to resolve either existing or forecasted problems from a capacity standpoint. And again, those are looking at organic growth in those systems over a six-year period. Our last comprehensive plan for our main water system, or what we call our large systems, was completed in 2017, and it's actually being updated as we speak today. We anticipate having by the end of 2023, we'll have the draft view of that as well. We do have some smaller systems, and the last comprehensive plan for those small systems was done in 2010, but it's reviewed on an annual basis. And there's very low growth in those smaller systems, so we haven't justified, you know, really doing a larger comprehensive plan on those. But we are keeping a close eye on them. And again, and I want to emphasize here, too, is that in addition to the wastewater system, those larger applications, such as, you know, Triad and Maple, that large development over here in West Wenatchee, Mission Ridge and Peshastin, Those do trigger additional, you know, system analyses for the specific water system that's, you know, kind of independent from our six-year comp plans. And it works fairly well right now. But if some of these folks decide to execute on some of those plans, we may need to kind of rethink some of our planning strategies on a move-forward basis. I want you to know, though, we're watching it very closely and having a lot of conversations from a planning perspective.
What is Triad Maple?
Triad Maple is the development just west of Maple Street, west of Western, the large development in West Wenatchee here. It was just under 450 units or lots, I would say. So I'm going to turn it over to Chad, and he's going to refresh our update on our distribution.
Not a lot's changed here, so it's going to probably go through fairly quickly. But going back to the electrical side and the EV, what we're trying to do here, substation planning, ensuring that we can effectively respond. I think the board's guidance over the years to me has been that we want to make sure that we can effectively respond to capacity requirements and needs. And one of the longest portions to do that, parts of, to do that, is building substations, of course, transmission lines too. So we want to put a lot of effort into the planning and trying to understand where we might need substations in the future. Our world has gotten a lot more complex, I think everybody would readily agree with. And so too has trying to understand what the future capacity needs might be. And the EV is one component of it that I would have never seen coming when I wrote our planning guidelines 20 years ago. And also the other thing that's changing a lot too is usage. So we're talking about organic things. So, how people are using their existing infrastructure is changing quite a bit, and none of those are permitted, meaning there's no required permit or no notification mechanism that might be in place. So things like VRBOs and timeshares, where if somebody's second home might have gone unused for a better portion of the year, now is being occupied all year round. People plugging in electric vehicles into their homes, that's changing existing infrastructure. So there's other things beyond just new units and new meters that are driving the need to install capacity, and we're trying to understand what those look like. And being able to respond, the biggest and longest piece of that 5+ years at best for building a substation. So we're really trying to spend quite a bit of time understanding how long it takes us to build these, where the next ones might go. We understand that our planning is always going to have to be adjusted, so we're adjusting that on an annual basis. Building the substations, permitting, long lead time items can be complex too. Available staff and resources and designs or the community outreach and the community engagement components of these sometimes can be in depth. And so really trying to do quite a bit to plan for these. On the screen, the yellow ones are near future substations that we plan on doing that we currently have property for. And the red ones are ones that we're seeking property and working on property for now. So here's a list. We're maintaining a 20-year plan of substation build. We believe at this point in time we need to have at least 3 substations in any given phase, in the planning phase, property acquisition phase, construction phase, design phase. We need to have 3 active at any given time to meet what our current forecast is. Of course, that can change, and we'll scale our project plan. Our build functions being head up by Gary Rice, he's doing a great job. And so this is our current plan. We're updating this every year, maintaining a 20+ year plan. As systems change, demographics change, usage change, we'll have to adjust this, but I think we're poised to be able to. So some of the activities that are going on right now, we've got a couple of pictures of North Shore Substation construction. I think that's well known. We're in permitting process for Leavenworth, which we're currently calling Bavarian Substation there, Chumstick and North Road. Wenatchee Foothills, Wenatchee, we're upsizing. We're going for through environmental review. We're going to more than double about double the capacity of the station in downtown Wenatchee. Related to the development that we expect to occurring on the West Wenatchee, we're seeking property. It remains to be seen when we would start developing that in terms of a construction, but we'll be monitoring what the developers are doing so that we can respond. Of course, we don't want to have capacity installed and that is not going to be used, but we also want to have capacity available and ready to be used too. So, and then Malaga and some other Malaga property is ongoing. We're in discussions, early discussions about that. There's some capacity needs in the Manson area in addition to what we're doing in North Shore now, so that's probably just a peek in the bag what we're going to be looking at next. And then we have various substations. So these are all the new ones. Then we have various substations that we're rehabbing, adding a few megawatts of capacity to bring it up to today's standards. There's several of those that are going on at the same time. So a lot of substation activity. There's no questions on kind of that. We just want to show you a picture of, so this is Dana and Henderson Road, this North Shore substation. Significant amount of grading that was required in order for us to utilize this site that was selected through a process with the community. There's still some places that are going to be seen, so there's quite a landscaping activity that's going to be going on with this. Very impressed with our contractor that we have on site. They're very methodical about working around the snow and various things to get started as soon as they could.
Yeah.
Andy created a cool function. So this was just last couple of weeks. So significant progress is being made. You can see in the lower corner there's a number of foundations that have already been poured. This is the rough grade being set. This is a power transformer coming down into the station. Fairly steep grades here, dropping down in a hole, so just added contingency there. We had a tow truck, a fairly large tow truck, connected to the back of the truck just so we had more brakes and more power in order to make sure the truck driver was not concerned about getting down there on his own, so we added some insurance to that. But we were able to make that happen. The project team, there's the substation power transformer being lifted onto its pad, so making progress. This should be, most of the construction will be completed at the end of the year, and then we'll be working on commissioning and energizing into the first part of the year. So making significant progress here. Thanks for your support on this project. It's been welcoming.
I just have to say this is really exciting to see this. Having been a commissioner early in the process and being involved in the public outreach and the site selection, and now seeing this picture, I'm just really happy. Thank you for making this happen.
Appreciate thank you. Your support.
Chad, are those the new poles? There was coming off that transmission line. I think there was some pre-work that was being done on that.
Visually, nothing has changed up there yet. Mm-hmm. But that structure that you see there in the background is going to be replaced with two or three pole structures up there on up and down side of that. The lines will then tap in, and that wood structure will be removed, and it'll be steel in there. They haven't started that. They've received the poles, but they haven't started that work yet.
I was just curious.
So visually, that will probably be one of the impacts for folks because it's up on the hill.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, wrapping up, just summarize that. New construction for residential just remains steady with that. Focus on multifamily housing. We are still forecasting our standard year of new meters, 800 plus. That's consistent with our historical numbers. Electrical vehicle charging stations continues to emerge, and we are continuing to be responsive to that. We have that vigorous electrical substation build plan, and we're continuing pace with that. Appreciate your support there. water and wastewater planning efforts, we covered those. They are being influenced by those larger applications, those single large applications. So we're continuing to keep a close eye on that as well. Our planned utility infrastructure, in particular on our fiber system and our electric system, is positioned really well to meet the needs of our customers into the future. So,
super.
With that, we'll
thank
wrap
you.
Up.
Any questions, commissioners? Great presentation. We always like to know what's coming down the pike.
Great. I would just add that the point that was made about three substations having to be in one phase or another all at the same time is pretty significant change for us. It wasn't that long ago we have one in one of those phases, so that's a pretty significant change for this team. So thank you, and thanks for trying to stay out and ahead of it. And I think you might have refuted the old adage that water and electricity don't mix by your presentation. Their water and wastewater points were a follow-up action item from a prior board meeting, the capacity planning. So thank you for covering, Veron.
Yep, you bet.
It's all part of transmission and distribution, water or electricity.
Yep. Right. A lot of similarities.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Insurance update.
Yeah, with us is Ron Gibbs. Welcome, Ron.
Good morning.
Good morning, Ron.
Oh, yeah. You're in the ship. I should.
No, you can do it from here. I just get it all.
Let me get up there. Yeah. All right. Well, we are here today to talk about upcoming insurance renewal. Get this up here. So this is our annual update that we do each year. July 1st is the renewal date, and then we will be negotiating up to the renewal date. And the reason we have, we'll have a motion that we're proposed authorizing the insurance program renewal with a up to, or actually not to exceed amount of $5,500,000. And we always use a not to exceed amount because of the negotiations keep going right up to the renewal date. Sometimes we need some flexibility in case unexpected quotes come in. So this program renewal supports the district value of stewardship, protecting public resources entrusted to us, managing risks, and by controlling costs. So I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the considerations that went into play for this year's renewal. Inflation continues to be an issue that we're dealing with. So in 2022, we appraised Rocky Reach, and in 2023, this year, we appraised Rock Island. Our property values went from $4.6 billion in 2021 to $6.1 billion in 2023.
That's so mind-boggling.
Yeah, it's, and this is, I would add to the appraisal company that we use is maybe one of the most respected, if not the most respected, in the industry, and they're used by a number of different insurance companies. And I felt like the Rock Island appraisal came in favorable for the district, to be quite honest. So could have been interesting if this had gone a different direction. But so we really only had a 7.5% increase over this last year. But again, I think just reading the newspapers, everybody sees what impact inflation is having, and we're no exception. Wanted to point out, too, that our largest insurance company, a company called Aegis, gave our generation maintenance a rating of excellent. And that was based on a visit when they came out in May. They put together a report looking at the way we operate our generation. And then we had them sit down with the asset management group and go through that whole program. And they came away quite impressed. And they actually outlined that the asset management program was a driver for them choosing excellent rating for us. And then that report goes out to all of our insurance companies. So we'll be able to use that in our future presentations to highlight the good work that our teams are doing. So wildfire risk obviously continues to drive the liability increases that we're seeing. We have a surcharge with the same company, Aegis, that also participates in the liability program of $350 million. I'm sorry, 350,000. Our property limits are 350 million. EIM is another carrier that has a surcharge of 180,000. So these two insurance companies provide the first 95 million of our 150 million in limits. So they're pretty integral to our program. The other carriers don't really, they don't report what they charge for wildfire, so we don't know exactly what that number is. I will say that based on what we're hearing from underwriters, that some of the increases that we've seen have been somewhat limited because of the wildfire mitigation work that we're doing. For example, Aegis, that $350,000 surcharge is actually their lowest level that they do. Some utilities in our region are getting up to $1 million surcharge. So that's they've stated that that's have is to do the reason that we're at that lowest level has to do with our wildfire mitigation work that we're doing. We're also seeing that liability markets in general are starting to show some signs of stabilization. We've been seeing increases the last several years. Last year, for example, our premiums that are impacted by wildfire risk went up by 31%. This year, we're at 18%. Still a high number, but maybe we're starting to see some signs of, you know, that those super large increases are diminishing. Also, in the last several years, quite a few insurance companies quit writing wildfire risk altogether, stepping away from wildfire risk. This year, we haven't seen companies stepping away, so the people that are the insurance companies that are there remain stable for this year. I mentioned the $350,000 surcharge. That was an increase of $115,000 compared to what we paid last year. But Aegis has stated that they're not going to have any more increases in the foreseeable future for that surcharge. So the remaining part of their rate only went up 7%. So again, next year, I think we won't have that particular surcharge increase. We had some carriers only increase rates by 9% this year, which seems is still a high number, but when comparing the 31% that we saw last year, it's definitely an improvement. So I would estimate that next year, unless we have some major wildfires in the region, that we hopefully will improve on that 18% that we saw this year for the wildfire risk. So on this slide, we talk a little bit about the process that we go through to try to obtain the most competitive rates and terms. And that really involves messaging that we take out to the insurance companies. I know we have a couple of new commissioners, so I prepared some remarks for them. So hopefully they'll listen in at a future date. But each year, you know, as many are aware, I develop a marketing strategy and I try to research the issues that insurance companies seem to be most concerned with for the year. And once I identify those concerns, I gather information and I also do research. So I meet with the subject matter experts around the district, bring that research together, and then put that all together into presentations. And I, with messaging that highlights the ways that we either meet or exceed industry best standards. So it's really is a marketing presentation. That's what the industry calls it, because we're marketing the district to those insurance companies, selling them that, you know, we are a quality risk worth insuring. And I would say too that the proactive approach that we take in managing risk at the district of all types has really helped develop a good reputation within the insurance industry. And a lot of the underwriters I've known for many, many years and get a lot of good positive feedback based on the programs that we're doing. In fact, Aegis, again, coming back to Aegis, their liability underwriter commented that our class-leading risk mitigation strategies when it comes to wildfire was a reason for why our rates were lower than other utility peers that we have. So it is making an impact. So this year we made presentations to individually to 20 different insurance companies. And we talked about the liability side, the wildfire risk mitigation, of course, those strategies, including the vegetation management standards, the fire safety outage management program, our reclosing setting program, and then the fact that we've had no losses for many, many years. Now on the property side, we talk about the investments in modernizing our generation, including investments in support facilities, development of our data analytic capabilities as we work towards predictive maintenance. Talk a lot about that we're really striving to kind of get there. in our generation program, generation maintenance program. We talk about HRI, the extended warranty with GE, and of course the asset management program and the updated property appraisals. So we'll start to get into some of the numbers for the quotes for this year. You'll see that last year the premium was $2,141,500, and this year we're estimating $2,680,000. So earlier you'll recall I mentioned that our general liability coverage went up by 18%. Well, this category includes general liability, auto liability, and public officials liability. And unfortunately, we did have a correction in our public officials liability premiums that caused this premium overall to go up by 25% in this category. And that, I think, transpired because our broker tells us that we were, when compared to his other utility clients, we were getting really, really competitive rates. And so this year we had one of our carriers discontinue providing coverage for us at those low rates. So we had to replace that coverage at the market rate. And then we had another carrier actually double their rate on us just to get us back to the market level. So this is sort of a one-time correction. We would anticipate those rates to stabilize going forward. So a little bit disappointing because we were doing better on the wildfire side to have this correction this year. But I think, again, going forward, I think we would anticipate having lower increases than we have had this year overall. On the property side, last year we paid $2,300,000, and we're estimating this year paying $2,500,000, and that's an increase of 8.6%. So again, this one is really following closely with the inflation, which was at 7.5%. But we are continuing negotiations, so we hope to get that number down even further, which is also true on the liability side. So all combined, all of our premiums have increased to 18% this year based on our current quotes. And again, I think we would anticipate, you know, we've had some large increases, and I would anticipate next year hopefully having a better story to tell based on indications that we're seeing in the markets. So we're recommending that we renew the policies this year with the same coverage that we had last year, with the exception of the other liability category, which I think you've received some information about, where we've increased the limit from $5 million to $10 million. And I would say, too, that during the budgeting process last year, we anticipated some challenging markets, and so the program renewal does come with under budget for the year. And then again, of course, continue to negotiate. We, for information purposes, include an option for a lower public officials liability limit. But when comparing the pricing to the benefit of the $25 million in coverage, we think that maintaining the $100 million limit is prudent for the cost of $90,000. So this is the proposed motion, which would authorize expenditures not to exceed $5,500,000 plus surplus lines taxes and fees for the purchase of district insurance. Are there any questions?
Questions?
It's just a comment looking at that bar chart. You had wildfires in the west have had an impact. Yes. I mean, there's a curve there, and Hopefully the insurance companies have caught up with that, and with the work we're doing, hopefully they'll be willing to pick even better picture of mitigation that we're doing.
I was definitely encouraged by the 9% increases compared to some of the other larger ones that were more associated with the surcharges. So I'm hopeful that next year we'll see much better result. But it all really also comes down to the wildfire activity this
right.
year.
Any other questions, commissioners? There's a request for a motion right up there. So
I would a motion to authorize expenditures by the district not to exceed $5,500,000 plus surplus lines, taxes, and fees for the purchase of the district insurance for July 1, 2023 through 24, policies upon terms and conditions approved by the general manager.
Is there a second?
I would second.
It's been moved and seconded. The motion has just been read. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is carried.
Thank you, Ron.
Thank you, Ron.
Thank you. Yes, we will continue to pursue and negotiate the best insurance terms by July 1st. And if we have some material changes, we'll be back with the board. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ron.
Thank you.
Thanks for all your good work.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Got a good team behind you as well.
Yeah.
All right. Latecomers policy.
Yeah, with us for this one is Sarah DeLozier and Lyle Moore, and no action required today. This is to bring you up to speed on our latecomer policy and some potential changes we're considering, so looking for your input.
Good morning, Commissioners.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome.
We are very eager to be here today. This has been a very long process, so we hope we answer a lot of questions as we walk through this presentation. So thank you, Kirk. My name is Sarah DeLozier. I'm the Customer Service and Dispatch Supervisor in Customer Utilities.
I'm Lyle Moore, Supervisor for Customer Service Engineering.
So again, today, why are we here? We would love to review the current latecomers policies, challenges, and opportunities with you. We would also like to explore some policy options, review that recommendation, and gather your feedback. As Kirk mentioned, there is no action today. What I'd first like to do before we jump into the presentation is take you on a journey for just a moment. So if you'd bear with me, I would appreciate if you would imagine yourself as a customer. You are really excited to get your new electric service, maybe water service. You apply, you're working with the engineer, and then you learn that the engineer is not able to provide you with a cost estimate because they have to wait for a customer that's ahead of you to connect their service. You realize that this is going to be a delay for your project. You become frustrated, maybe emotional. Your experience becomes not so good. Now take a moment, imagine yourself as a staff member trying to find a positive way to explain a policy that will likely create an unpleasant scenario for a customer. You're striving for that positivity, knowing delays are going to create frustration for the customer you're frustrated to. This scenario is one that we've seen over and over again as customers are connecting their lots and needing power, requiring a line extension, maybe connecting to a line extension. We've had customers upset. I've had a gentleman almost in tears, really trying to find creative ways to work inside the policy and still meet their needs has been difficult, to say the least. We want you to know that we've taken our many customer experiences, their challenges, taken those things that they've recommended to us into consideration before we came here today. So know that we've incorporated those into these recommendations as well. And we're really here today with the intent to better our customers' experience while aligning closely with the utility industry standards. So what is latecomers? Latecomers is a policy that allows an individual who has installed utility infrastructure to recover a portion of the costs from others if others later connect and benefit from the original work. It does apply to water, wastewater, electric. It does not apply to fiber. If you are interested in the appendix, this latecomers policy dates back to the 1940s, 1948. Wow. And you can learn about its history and kind of the migration through that time period to today. As an example, so I'm going to use Andy as my friend here, who came to the district, and let's say he wanted to install a line to reach his property. He paid perhaps $10,000 to the district to do that. Lyle comes along later and says, I am really excited to get power to my property, and now he's connecting to Andy's line extension. This is the scenario that we're talking about with latecomers. And then the unhappy customer would be me, who's wanting to connect on to Andy's, and that's having to wait for Lyle to complete his connection, if that helps put this into perspective. Go ahead. So today, the current policy is based on a per-foot cost estimate or assess to a customer connecting to an existing line. Again, Lyle connecting to Andy. Customers, in the scenario, Andy, may submit non-PUD originated receipts to be included in the total cost. So as an example, there is some work that is required from customers to do. Those receipts, for instance, digging in a trench, some of the conduit that they may have purchased today could be incorporated into the overall cost of the project. The original construction presently is eligible for 10 years after the completion of a project, unless they've sold their property, with no limit on those who can connect. So it, with payouts, it can go on and on. Primary industrial and land developments are ineligible. Those customers have an opportunity to recoup costs through land or lot sales within their or within their business model. So today, those customers are not eligible.
So with today's current policies, and the challenges some of that we're addressing, portions of the policy are hard to understand for our customers. It's a very stepwise process, and so it gets challenging. We try to explain that. We have interactions with everyone that we talk to, but that's what we've identified. Customers have an have a hard time understanding what the policy is trying to get across. Policy does not allow for consecutive applications to be processed at the same time. It's very stepwise, and so just determining a cost for the second line extension, we have to wait for the first line extension to be completed because we need to know when it happens in the process. This impacts that customer experience. What we see sometimes is the impacts of that project then delays the project, negatively impacts the experience. Throw in material delays this year with what we had right there. Huge impact to line extensions. Customer A's proceeding, all of a sudden their equipment's delayed because maybe it's unique. The second and third customers are all paused. If we're talking about the money component of that, they have trouble getting funding. Again, negative impact to customer experience. What we see sometimes is customers recognizing our policy, they go out and they try to get creative on their own. So behind the scenes, they're doing a quasi latecomers policy in the neighborhoods with good intentions. But there again, it's an impact that we experience because then we have to explain that customer, great idea, but it's not aligned with policy. Substantive connectors are no longer eligible if there's a property sale component of this. We've had some challenges with that. We'll explain that just a little bit further. And the current policy right now talks about service connections, and so we struggle at times with it can be the same individual, but it's a second connection, so then we have to manage and work through what that latecomer component looks like there. On the district side, determining the eligibility is a challenge. Customers get creative with names on applications. They may be dealing with an application in their name. Maybe they want it in a contractor's name. It all impacts eligibility again. Part of policy is allow customers to submit receipts based on work that they did that gets added into the calculation. To accept those, we have to validate those receipts. So we're putting staff in a situation of reviewing receipts that are created by someone else when we may not know all the aspects of what actually went into that work. Eligibility length, right now the policy currently is there for 10 years. That pushes on the 6-year records retention component of our line extension application, so we're not aligned right there. Portions of the policy are not easily explained and hard to understand. Even with staff working on this every day, they still run into challenges with that. Customers come up with all types of creative questions. Takes time for us to pause, reevaluate that. Are we aligned with policy? And then we've experienced some significant legal challenges with name changes. Policy addresses that if you sell your property, looks like a name change, then you're no longer eligible. But what we're finding is that customers are getting creative with how they manage their affairs, maybe for inheritance being passed on at the end of their life, thinking of their kids. These name changes have been significant challenges for us in reviewing them and trying to make sure they fit within policy. To help us understand and to learn what the industry is doing, we participated in a Waputa survey in 2021, looked at 17 utilities. Roughly half of those utilities no longer have latecomers or never did. Or we see a trend of them moving away. And since the survey, there has been an additional one or two utilities that have stepped away from latecomers.
So just so that I can understand what you just said on that, so does that mean that when those applications come in, they try to address, instead of one at a time, in turn, they're addressing all of them at the same time, or what does that mean?
It's a very stepped approach. So we do try and help our customers and address many applications at the same time. When we start putting them into the latecomers policy, so if we identify that they're associated with a line extension, and perhaps there's more than one that are associated with that line extension and would be subject to this policy, then we really need to understand who's going to finish first.
No, but my question was, for those utilities that don't have that, do they?
They just don't. There's just not a recovery alternative for late or for the original investment.
So the first guy that runs the line and a lot of people tap into it, the first guy pays the bill.
Correct.
Oh. Yep.
Looks like growth pays for growth. They've trended more towards first in, that's the growth. You pay a component of that. The other component of what we found in the survey is that those that do have latecomer policies have adjusted them, and they've got very clear eligibility. Maybe specifically, this is just for residential. They put policy terms in there, and what we saw was 5 years or less. Number of payouts was typically two, so you only have two more that can connect that have some kind of latecomer responsibility. And then some of them set some clear minimum costs. That project has to be at a certain threshold before they even consider it. So we looked at our data as well, and in our data, we sampled at random 100 line extensions, and we looked at them at a 5-year component, so midway through that 10-year term, and then at the 10-year term. And typically what we were seeing is latecomer connections out of that 100, in the first 5 years, there's 5, and we go to 10 years, there was 6. We typically saw there was 2 connectors or less. We saw the average disbursement, and then we see that typically the connectors all happen within the first 4 years. So what we look at for costs to administrate a payout on a latecomers at the minimum is about 5 hours of staff time, and that costs us about $300. What this doesn't capture is all of the conversations you have anytime there's a question. And there's always seems to be a question. Staff does a great job trying to manage those questions and working through it. Frontline staff gets involved. Questions get elevated to supervisor level, like Sarah and I. We do a lot of team approach on all of those reviews. We use resources like legal to look at our policy to make sure we're understanding what the interpretations were, what the original intent was. If we go down to, we think about latecomers in the sense, every application we receive gets some type of formal review because we need to make sure it's not in there. And that's about a half hour of customer service engineering time. So every application that comes in, question has to be asked, is there a component of latecomers or will there be? The other part that we saw is that our average line extension costs are trending up significantly. It's material costs that what we're seeing. And that number is up close to $13,000 right now. So going forward, we put together, or we reviewed, basically three options of what that is. option one is to just status quo. Let's do nothing, keep working through it, focus energy on staff. Option two is eliminate latecomers policy. That really is a staff preferred option to just abandon it. Look at it, has it served its purpose there? Rely on growth pace for growth. Option three is more of a phased approach. And this is a staff supported approach that we look at this phased approach in a two policy approach. One is making some changes to the existing policy. And the second part is starting a brand new policy. To help us understand these three options, we looked at them side by side, and we started diving into what we thought saw were five key components of latecomers. Industry standard, a risk, a policy administration, a resource impact, and a PUD cost. Also taken into account, we tried to look at what best practices, where we want to end up. We looked at growth pace for growth. We looked at what the customer experience is. How do we keep it up there? How do we make it better? We looked at how do we create ways for our staff to be successful? HPI, look at stuff that you know, we don't make mistakes on, we don't miss anything. And to try to fit this into the best for the most for the longest. And where we land on option three that we support is, if we look at industry standard, it's moving us towards industry standard. That's the trend. We look at risk, it significantly mitigates risk that we have in missed opportunities for experience, misinterpreting what customers are given to us. We look at policy administration, it significantly increases success in administering a policy. We look at the resource impacts. This helps our staff be more successful. And we look at PUD costs. We can reduce some of our PUD costs in just time that we spend. So part one of option three, we would look at the existing policy. We recommend removing the sale component of the existing policy. So we don't have to consider and worry about, is this property meeting the definition of being sold? One of the key things that we look for in finding information here is the county assessor records. What we find with county is they have work, they're a little bit slow sometimes, they're impacted by work, they see that. By mitigating this portion here, we don't need to worry about the trust component. We don't need to worry about someone trying to be creative and managing their assets or how they want to manage it. Trust component has been a big challenge for us, and legally we spent lots of time looking at that. The other portion of part one would be to expire the current policy at January 1 of 2024. We would continue to maintain the 10-year component of that with the one change of the property sale, but in January 1 of 2024, we would create a new policy that's got some clear criteria.
So speaking about part two, the new policy, as you saw in the data before, we would like to establish a reimbursement term of 4 years. As we saw, most customers connect within the first 4 years, and this also aligns more with the industry standards. We would also like to establish a minimum project cost threshold. As you saw, or as you probably have seen, building costs are increasing, labor, materials, and such. Our trends are going upwards on our costs as we know it today, too. Establishing a minimum cost helps us to minimize coming back and asking for increases in the future as we monitor how this part two of the recommendation works. Additionally, we would like to limit the number of subsequent payouts to two. As you saw previously, on average, we saw no more than two. On average, it was less than two. We would also like to offset amounts to pay off utility account unpaid delinquent balances. So there are times where we have customers who are on their way to collection for their utility balance, for their monthly utility bill, and we're giving them money back when we're not making ourselves whole. So we'd like to get our bills up and paid and give them the difference of that amount. We would also like to limit the reimbursement to PUTI-originated costs, customer-paid costs to us. This ensures that those costs are accurate and is fair to those subsequent connections. We would also like to clarify the eligibility criteria, focusing on the residential single-lot customers. Those are customers that are likely not planning to sell immediately. They're not likely to gain those costs back in their lot sales, such as through a subdivision or through their business model with industrial or commercial business plans. And we would like to begin this new policy January 1, if supported, of 2024. So today we want to thank you for your time, and we are certainly eager to hear your thoughts on this recommendation. Again, there are no decisions to be made today, but if it is supported, we would like to return to seek approval.
Commissioners, questions? Did I understand you correctly when you said we've had a latecomer's fee since 1948?
It's been in some form of that. So in 1948 was the beginning of trying to figure out what portion customers should pay and what portion the PUD should pay, being a public utility. So it's migrated over the course of the years with the introduction of connection fees at certain times, the introduction the customer starts paying for transformers and line extension costs. And then it's been this way for 20 years, I think, to where the words are close to the way they are in policy today, where we've tried to manage what latecomers look like. You know, really, latecomers is, the PUD gets no money for latecomers. We're just a facilitator and a manager of that, but we have the burden of explaining it, managing that policy, handling questions. It's a changing dynamic with our customers. Our customers are changing. They want something different from us. So that's been our challenge, is how do we support our customers, explain and manage and just be the go-between at the expense of a cost that impacts all ratepayers. And so that's the trade-off here. This is impacting all of our ratepayers in some way or another. And so by putting these criteria in there, we're hoping to limit that cost and to get in line with our initiatives, growth base for growth, increasing the customer experience.
Yeah. I would just add that they've done a fantastic job of researching all angles, and you notice the staff preferred option is option 2. After a fair amount of discussion, we're recommending option 3 because I think Sarah's illustration was fantastic, and that they're in the example she gave, there is a very satisfied customer in that example, and Andy over there. He did a line extension, and he got some of it recouped. And so throwing out the latecomer policy altogether, eliminating it, does result in some potential customer dissatisfaction for somebody that spent a fair amount of money extending the line, and within 4 years, somebody else connects to that and benefits from it. What I really like about the recommendation is it can be a phased approach. What they're recommending is take a step, try and simplify it, reduce the amount of time and energy it takes, and I think there is going to be some increased customer satisfaction in simplifying both the timeline and the requirements with which customer A gets paid back. Doesn't take very long for me to try and wade through my cell phone bill and understand it, and very complicated, and you know, I can spend a half an hour just like they spend a half an hour or an hour. And even if somebody does a good job explaining it, I don't walk away satisfied because it's very complicated. So I think what they're trying to do here is take that next step, phased approach to create a better customer experience, less administrative costs, and give us some time to evaluate that. And if things seem to work pretty well, we can continue down that. And if they're not working very well, we can look at that other option, option 2 down the road.
And it seems like the pressure on you is probably going to do nothing but ramp up over the next few years with the increased pressure for development. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a lot of people that have property that first person paying the bill will feel the angst, and if we just tossed it out. So yes. Appreciate the thoughtful approach you're taking. I personally look forward to seeing what your refined proposal will look like.
All right. Well, thank you for your time today. We greatly appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you both.
Good presentation. Yeah.
Sorry.
So I don't believe we have any public in the room at this point. So my call for public comment would be, there you are. We do. I apologize, Susan. You're semi-public. Yeah. So, I will move on. It's 20 to 12, and there might be an opportunity to finish this morning. So let's.
I'll go ahead and dangle that in front of us.
So let's move right on to the consent agenda, which was modified earlier to include resolution number 12. Is there a motion to approve the consent agenda?
So it makes a motion.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is carried. And resolution 11.
So I would just like to add that we will see what we can do. We weren't prepared to move into resolutions right away.
Oh,
but we will see what we can.
Well,
do.
We can skip over.
Yeah,
for the
I
moment.
Was thinking if you wouldn't mind, we do have Mike Bradshaw here for one of the manager items.
That
may take the rest of the time.
Oh, okay.
And so we thought we'd go there next. Okay. Mike, do you want us to try and get?
If you think that we're going to need. You know, more than a half an hour.
Okay. Let's see what we can do.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I think I can be faster too. So just an update. First, Mike Bradshaw, Director of Energy Structuring and Trading, just here to provide a brief update on the Cap and Invest program and specifically targeting an update on the auctions that have happened year to date. There's been two. And then also an update on the no cost allowance allocations. I think the last time we spoke was about the CCA or the Climate Commitment Act was in May during the Energy Resources Update. At that time, we mentioned that their first auction, well, first of all, the program started January this year, so it's very new. The first auction was held late February, and the clearing price for all of the allowances that were auctioned off was $48, which resulted in a $300 million revenue stream to the state. Since then, we've had the second auction, which is May 31st, and that cleared at $56.01, so an increase from the first auction. And again, all allowances were auctioned off for both 2023 as well as 2026. And so they have a kind of the current year, and they have a future year, typically 3 years in advance. The current year, the 2023, was $56.01, and the 2026 price was $31.12, so pretty large discount for that 2026 period. That resulted in about $550 million to the state. There are some pricing mechanisms to try to limit the volatility and essentially the price of how high these allowances get. There's a kind of like two speed bumps that they get triggered at an auction. There is a mechanism where you have a out-of-cycle auction. These auctions are each quarter. So that's four per year. But if an auction price settles higher than a certain threshold number that's predetermined, $51 is the lower tier one, and then there's a $66 tier two. So because the second auction was at $56, that was above the tier one price, and so that triggers this out-of-cycle auction that will happen in August. So the purpose of that is to inject more allowances into the program, try to keep the supply there and push the price down. And so that will be happening on August 9th, and those are at predetermined prices, and they'll be at $51 about 500,000 allowances will be at that price, and then about 500,000 will be at the Tier 2 price of $66. All this is pretty new. The market's digesting it. How you do these out-of-cycle, they call them APCR auctions, how you allocate, how many will be in those auctions, is all kind of new. So, but that's been triggered on the second auction of the program. So California hasn't hit their triggers, and they've been going since 2013. They were more along the floor. This is a very aggressive program, and so on number swing number two, we already hit one of those levels. So that is happening. And then current pricing in the secondary market, so these can be purchased and sold secondarily, and that's right around that $63 to $70. And so you have these kind of thresholds of 66 is that tier two price. So that's kind of the pricing threshold that you would think, okay, if this happens to clear in Q3 above that, then, or price is relatively secondarily in the secondary market close to that APCR2 price. Update on no-cost allowances. Again, just a refresher that the intent of the no-cost allowance is to mitigate an entity's cost compliance or compliance cost exposure. And for utilities, because they are subject to CETA, which itself carries a cost burden to comply with that program, really didn't want to be double whammed. And so they were allocated no-cost allowances. So we received our no-cost allowances back in April 25 this year. We had $226,451. There was a slight adjustment, not to Chelan's allocations, but Department of Ecology did release a new schedule of allowances, and some entities were reduced. I should say reduced. Their future allocations for future periods would be reduced. The 23s are in their bucket. They're not going to move. And then others were increased, so the future allocation would be increased. We looked at a couple of those entities that had those adjustments, and it looked like the biggest thing was the change in the load forecast, or the source that Ecology used for the load forecast may have changed. Overall, the adjustments actually result in more allowances being doled out than less. There is an opportunity to update the supply and load forecast. If you recall, we was adopted, I think, September of last year by the board. There is an opportunity to update that by July 31st of this year. We are currently looking at our forecast and making that determination kind of as we speak. So if we do come to you before July 31st, I think we're targeting July 24th. That might be a time when we come with a revised forecast. Again, still kind of working through that internally. And then the greenhouse gas reporting deadline, which is a new part of the program, typically happens every June. But given this is the first time for a lot of for utilities, essentially, that don't have emitting resources, that was it's kind of new to a lot of folks. So that was pushed from June to September. I think that is all I have for an update since the last couple months. Any questions?
It'll be interesting to see how this whole thing works or doesn't. Just a comment.
Yeah, I would commend Mike and the Energy Resources team. This has been a lot of work to try and stay on top of how these things work and implications, and so just appreciate all their effort.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, thank you. You have spoken and people have arrived. So.
They were listening in.
why don't we skip to the resolution? And Brett did say he would be prepared to go. Thank you, Mike. So we do have David Lodge here for Resolution 11, if you'd like me to jump back there.
Sure.
David, welcome again. This is a resolution ratifying field work order change orders number 27 through 29 and further approving field work order change order number 30 for the Service Center project with Apture Construction Company of Puyallup, Washington for construction of the Service Center project pursuant to General Contractor Construction Manager Contract number 18-91.
Good afternoon. Well, good morning still.
Yeah.
I'm going to change my notes.
You really were.
David Lodge, Project Management Manager. I've got a bunch of different items to cover in these change orders, but I want to start off by saying that all of these change orders are covered under the contingency within the project budget. So no changes requested to the overall project budget. So fieldwork order change order 27 was to increase contract time for phase one substantial completion. So the board is aware that shortly after my last visit, we had a quality issue with our precast stair treads. And rather than trying to repair in place, we made the determination to remove them and replace them. And so we granted Absher additional time to make that repair. So we extended phase one substantial completion to August 3rd with no cost change to the district. And did, since it expedites our move-in plan, we did increase liquidated damages associated with phase one. Fieldwork order change order number 28 was for a variety of different changes, totaling $481,424. Some of these included some electrical and technology revisions to meet operational needs. We added the scope of furniture data connections. We had all the data terminated at the wall, but needed to actually extend that through all the furniture partitions. Included that in the telecom contractor's scope of work. Also added insulation at parapets of the operations buildings. Determined that it would offset potential moisture issues from warm air rising up through the walls and condensating in the parapets, and a variety of other changes. There's a complete list of changes attached to the resolution. Fieldwork order change order number 29, additional construction issues totaling $496,465, include the disposal of expired roofing adhesives. So we had all of the roofing materials on site ready to do roofing before the delay in our construction sequence. And so those roofing adhesives expired on site. So we've changed all the roofs to mechanically fastened roofs, which actually gave us the benefit of being able to progress that work over the winter. But now we need to dispose of those adhesives that have expired. We also addressed some of the delay costs for the cultural delay costs for the masonry subcontractor and the finished carpenter. And then added utilities to the south end of the property in support of potentially a future restroom associated with the trail extension. It allows us to get them off-site and not have to excavate in the future within the facility. So then the change order that's being presented for approval today is change order number 30. And this is for the adding the scope of the racking and shelving to Absher Construction. So this scope was always identified as a owner furnished, owner installed scope within the overall project budget. But as we resequenced the turnover and having the different phases of completion, we identified a need to have Absher take on that scope of work so they could sequence the racking and shelving with their completion of each facility, each building. So Absher bid out that with a public bid and open bids June 1st, and the resulting bid price adds $1,198,444 to Absher's guaranteed maximum price. This did exceed our budget for that work, but we were able to use some of the contingency that we had in reserve to cover that cost. So like I said, we get the benefit of having Absher coordinate that work. So in total, change orders 27 through 30 bring contract 1891 to $121,458,047. And again, all of these changes funded from project contingency. Any questions?
Questions? Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Commissioners, we have capital budget revision first?
Or? Go ahead. You can vote on this.
Okay. We have resolution number 11 that is in need of a motion to approve.
So moved as written.
Is there a second?
Do I need to read the whole thing?
No. It's just the resolution.
Second. It's been moved and seconded to approve resolution number 11. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is carried. Okay. Capital budget revision.
Yep. Toby, why don't you come on up? Thanks, David. This is a proposed capital budget revision for the fiber expansion work, particularly for the Blewett Pass project. Welcome, Toby.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Toby. I'm a project manager under Court's division of EPM, and I'm here today to provide a brief introduction to the progress on the Blewett Pass public power benefit construction and to request a motion to increase that project budget. Our construction schedule, we are just putting boots on the ground and shovels in the dirt, beginning construction. We anticipate completion by the end of the year, with ready to serve customers the beginning of next year. And we have a highlighted area of the map within the county of where that new customer territory will be.
How many miles up Blewett Pass does that go, do you know?
So that's right from the highway junction. Mm-hmm. It's about 3 miles out.
Okay, so it doesn't get to the rock climbing place.
I don't know where the rock climbing place is. The southern end of Campbell Road, where Campbell Road comes back and
connects. Okay, Campbell Road, yeah, okay. There's 204 customers in that breadth.
Yes, yeah.
Wow.
Okay. Campbell Road. Can you give me an idea?
Okay. Trying to think which fruit stand. Yeah, you don't know where Campbell's Orchard is, and I do, but that wouldn't help you. But it's not that far up.
There's a large like mechanical shop, for buses and semis, things right at the junction of Campbell, and then some kind of a church or something just south of that as well.
So it's not past that up.
Right.
Yeah, that's the end of it right there.
But 204, I would not have.
It's pretty remote.
I would not have dreamed of that many. Yeah.
So what we're here today discussing is the way we've approached the distribution preparation work, which we're calling our distribution methodologies. The significant difference is in our original scope. We were focusing on the clearances and separations required by laws and regulations, and then minimizing the rest of the work to simplify the cost breakdown as opposed to what is required for make-ready work and what could be classified as distribution system work. Mm-hmm. When we realized as we approached ENEAT, what that left us with was some gaps in our goals and values. And so we went back to the table to kind of look at how should we leave the distribution system when we're done. And what we came up with was getting our system engineers involved and looking at the system improvements and their planning and their goals and objectives, making sure that those were tied into the areas we were working, system reliability and protection, wildfire environmental look, to get those other departments to look at our area and the scope of work that we're doing to incorporate any changes that the distribution system needed so that we can leave the best distribution system in place to serve the most amount of customers for the next 30 to 50 years. So we're not back out there replacing poles here in the near future. The system should be ready to go, which is where our costs drive up. Lower Blewett Pass was composed of two budgets, a distribution component and a fiber component. The combined budget for that was just over $2 million, and our estimate at completion is just over $3 million. So the distribution component, we're requesting board approval to increase the distribution project budget by approximately $900,000 for a new distribution budget of approximately $1.8 million. And with that approval, we can request the general manager to approve the increase to the fiber budget of approximately $200,000 for a new fiber budget of 1.8 $3.5 million. The fiber budget is within the general manager's delegated authority, and so that's where we kind of have these two separate out and highlighted. We're increasing both budgets, but the motion today will be for the board to approve the distribution budget. And this is our motion for your approval.
So it isn't very often that a board gets too excited about a capital budget revision, but this one gets me excited. So I'm pleased that you're bringing this forward. It makes me happy to keep pushing that out, and I commend everybody's effort to keep pushing, making those pushes. So I like this one. Okay. So I would like, with that, are you ready for a motion?
I am, absolutely.
I would recommend, I'd make a motion to approve number 13 as written.
Will that work? Okay.
Yep.
There's been a motion made to approve the capital budget revision as written, the motion as written. Is there a second?
I am pleased to second that motion. Yes.
All right. We've got a pleased motion and a pleased second. Is there any discussion? I'd like to make a comment.
Sure.
And it's part of the other part of being pleased is to see this is moving money between areas that used to not happen. And this is important. You know, the way you've approached this with the distribution people and the fiber people sitting down and working together, this is great. So thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you.
Enough of my editorial comment. Is any other discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is carried.
Thanks, Toby.
Thank you, Toby.
Thank you.
I have one more manager item, and that's it for me.
Okay, and ours won't take probably 10 minutes, so let's do it.
Okay.
If it meets with the approval of my fellow commissioners. Yeah. Okay.
Got Brett Bickford, who's going to... a lot of stuff happening in the energy industry right now, particularly in the utilities, looking at energy storage, new energy production, and we're trying to educate ourselves on all the different things that are happening out there. So I thought it'd be good for Brett to just share some of the things that he and others are learning about. No plans at this time, but just trying to educate ourselves with what's out there and where we should be thinking about potential in the future. So, Brett?
Yeah, so no pictures or anything, but just kind of a discussion between ourselves. But Sean and I collaborated and decided we should probably designate some folks that can collect, be kind of our subject matter experts and collect information from various sources. So if you guys have some that you've gotten from various seminars or things, that would be helpful too. Or if you're hearing about other PUDs that are doing things, if you forward them to Sean or I, we'll collect those. Sean's been looking at it from the power marketing side, and you know, what does it take to make these things feasible? You know, what would be the megawatt size? What would be the kind of the duration that we would need from an energy storage standpoint? There's lots of different technologies. So we're trying to get pricing. There seems to be a lot of new technologies, so we're trying to figure out which ones are really feasible and make sense. I'm kind of looking at it from the operation and maintenance side. What would it take to actually operate and maintain these facilities? What would the life cycle be? You know, what's the downtime to do overhauls and those kind of things? So not any siting, but we know what's maybe possible out there. So a couple things. With energy storage, so batteries are pretty obvious, but kind of the new technology is with other storage. So pump storage, it's water conveyance, right? Pump it up, gravity takes it back down. But there's some new technologies that are just basically using weight, which is great because then you don't have water rights issues, and where are you going to get it and pump it? And so there's a couple of startups that are proposing to have people come visit their sites, and so we might be looking at that in the future. But first, we want to see whether they're really cost effective and what's the utilization. So Sean has some money in his group to look at, you know, do we have the energy actually to power it up the hill, right? Because we got to get it up before we can run it back down. And so where do we have that extra capacity to do that, as well as, you know, where does it make sense in the time of day and things like that? New generation is really more interesting to me. So we have some folks in transmission that that, you know, came from the military. They worked in the nuclear side of the Navy. And so they've been kind of volunteered to be our subject matter experts. But in the small nuclear reactor side, kind of a setback, it looks like, on price and technology advancements. It looks like it's even another decade out. So we kind of scratched our heads and went, well, where else can we go? And we started thinking about geothermal. And so had a couple of conversations with Washington State Geologic Survey. And so they said they would put together some maps for us and show us if we've got any potential in Chelan County. They did identify some sources that aren't in our county. And so we've had a couple of discussions with those folks about, you know, are they pursuing that? Are they interested in that as well? And so we don't have anything back, but Washington Geologic Survey was hoping in July to give us some maps and some stuff of what's, but there's nothing really surface oriented. It's pretty deep, so probably pretty expensive. And so kind of just soliciting what would it take to do exploratory development of those. And, you know, there's geothermal in California. So we've reached out and to try to get some pricing or some cost on what does it cost to operate those facilities. Yeah, so that's what I had to share.
Yeah, I think some of the, you know, just some of the drivers for why we're even educating ourselves is we certainly see new applications on interconnection requests in our county a great deal. And in the last couple of years, we've seen a significant increase there. The other thing that is quite interesting to us that's and see some of these things that are happening in the markets and the flexibility with taking some of the base load generation off and the flexibility that's going to be needed on the system, and that's where the storage comes in. The other thing is there's this element out there of where the transmission congestion is going to be, and so as there's desires to move potentially new facilities and industries into this area, there's all those things that come into play, and how do we best position ourselves to be able to serve them. So that's causing us to look at things like, oh, what generation would be out there that wouldn't potentially require a lot of transmission infrastructure. As we all know, the transmission infrastructure is something that takes more than a decade to build. There's a lot of talk about permitting reform that might shorten up those time frames, but we view it as important for us to be educating ourselves on all these different components to just understand what's out there and where we should be thinking depending on the multiple scenarios that we could find ourselves in down the road. So. Any questions for Brett?
Glad you're learning.
Yeah.
I'd like to just congratulate all the staff in terms of being innovative and think forward thinking on this topic. I think it's exciting. Anxious to have heard your report today.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So these mechanical things they're looking at, are they, do they spin? Do they go up a mountain and come down? Or what do these look like?
Yeah, there's one technology they've looked at. It's pretty simple. It's a huge weight on a track. And when you have surplus energy or low-cost energy, you pull it up the hill, and it just waits there until the right time, and then you send it down. And so it turns a generator. So you can, the motor, in the motoring phase, it pulls it up the hill and generates as it goes back down the hill. Hmm. They're not real fast, fairly slow, so you need a long track length, and the track can't be too steep, with this particular technology because it's a very, very large weight. So there's other technologies that have smaller weights and you can have steeper inclines, but you don't get necessarily the same energy production out of them.
Well,
when he says you send it down, it's under control.
Right.
Doesn't free fall.
You obviously heard Rebecca and I talk.
Very simple.
Yep.
Laws of physics engaged.
Yep.
So I'm going to look forward to having you share more of that learning as you go.
You bet.
Yes.
Thanks.
Thanks, Brett.
Okay. Other manager items?
That's it for manager items.
Okay. Commissioners, we've got a few items for commissioner items. We've got two special motions, but one thing I want to allow a little bit of time for my fellow commissioners to relay thoughts on last week's American Public Power Association meeting. So I don't know how we want to, let's do the motions first. We have a couple proposed motions, one on Tuesday, August 8th, 2023 at 1 p.m. at Confluence Technology Center, 285 Technology Way, for the purpose of holding a tri-commission meeting, and on Tuesday, September 19th at 2023 at 5 p.m. at Chateau Fair-LaPont, 1 Vineyard Way, Wenatchee, for the purpose of holding the Mid-Sea General Managers and Commissioners meeting. Is there a motion to pass those two meeting dates?
So moved on both motions.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the two special meetings. Is there any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motions are carried. Follow up on delegation of action items from previous board meetings.
We had the one for the water wastewater planning thresholds that you heard today during the load forecast update. And then did have one item from this meeting, which is to circle back with you all on what's driving the Kaler Glen application to Lake Wenatchee Wastewater Treatment Plant.
That can be a big change up there.
Yeah.
Okay. I just skipped right over, moved right out of commissioner items, and didn't allow you guys the opportunity to talk about APPA after it. Any thoughts for the people listening about what we experienced last week?
I'll start. The last week, the meeting, the conference that our president is talking about was an American Public Power conference that was attended by public utilities across the entire United States. And as a matter of fact, there were people there from Guam, so even U.S. territories, which, as you can imagine, would all have a variety of different utility services, as well as ways of providing those services to their customers. The sessions were extremely valuable, but what was equally of value was having the opportunity to chat with representatives from utilities across the nation, listen to the challenges that each utility is facing, which are similar but different. And each one has different nuances. And hearing how those representatives, in some cases mayors, in other cases commissioners, are looking at those challenges and tackling those challenges brings ideas and concepts, and it's a real thinking bed of ideas that we are able to bring back to Chelan PUD. Some apply, some do not, but some bring real interesting new ways of thinking, of approaching some of the challenges that we, as commissioners and as staff,
are faced with and or will be faced with in the future. So the meeting itself was tremendously valuable. We heard a great deal of valuable information, as I said, in the sessions, but I'm still chewing on some of the comments that I've heard from our friends in Iowa and some of the things that they're facing in the way of challenges and ways that they're looking to overcome some of those challenges. So it was a very worthwhile few days to spend in Seattle to attend the conference.
You know, and I just would second that kind of overarching camaraderie of dealing with challenges, probably more so than what I've experienced in past years, just, you know, climate changes and looking at the data around moisture and how that's impacting, you know, the Columbia Basin and the West Coast and, you know, really getting down to looking at electrification of vehicles and transmission. And it's just challenges. And so it, at least it made me feel at home that what we're looking at here is kind of what everybody else is looking at in their own particular area and their own particular needs, but lots of people working on solutions, and I just found it fascinating. It's a good conference.
Well, I would third both of your comments and add to it. For some reason this year, maybe it was because it was in Seattle, I took a greater opportunity to engage with some of the representatives from the outside or the utilities here in our state that at a different level. The one I mentioned to Andy early on was really an aha moment for me that King County Metro is in the process of electrifying. Their desire is to electrify their entire bus fleet, and they're looking for ways to do it. And they're actually looking over the mountains at us, but not here at Chelan Utility, but at Link Transit. And I, you know, that made me feel sort of a little warm fuzzy about Chelan County, that we're doing innovative things over here, and being able to observe our manager engage with the number one advocate in the state for removal of the Snake River dams was a good experience on my part, you know. So, Kurt, you handled yourself much better than I would have. So, those engagements are important for us here in Chelan County, and it's important for us to be aware of that bigger picture out there. So, it was a good conference. It was a very good conference. Any other commissioner items?
Appreciated our meeting up at the port the other day, and the partnership that we have with them and the ongoing, it kind of goes back to what we're talking about here. It was exciting to look at the economic development challenges and opportunities they are working on and how that eventually trickles down to us big time. And what's happening in the region and up at the airport and business development around the area, data centers. And so it was a very good meeting, and yeah, it's nice to participate in that discussion and know what's happening and where things are moving. So. Okay.
And for those staff that may not be aware, we've already filled Kirk and with Commissioner McKenna and I with our Upper Valley Commissioner meeting, had to sit down with the Regional Port Authority on Friday morning, and there were the four commissioners and State Representative Gaynor, so there were five of us, and we got a full-blown presentation on what the Regional Port Authority is doing, and a lot of interesting data points in that whole process. Good, it was a good session. So, any Any other commissioner items? Okay. So we're down to additional public input. I'm waiting. Okay. Any other matters of business that necessarily become before the commission? I understand we are not in need of an executive session.
That's correct.
So if there's no further business to come before the commission, we will stand adjourned.